Chapter 33. Morning made a considerable difference in my general prospect of life, and brightened it, so much that it scarcely seemed the same. What lay heaviest on my mind, was, the consideration that 6 days intervened between me, and the day of departure. For, I could not divest myself of a misgiving, that something might happen to London in the meanwhile, and that, when I got there, it would be either greatly deteriorated or clean gone. Joe and Biddy were very sympathetic and pleasant, when I spoke of our approaching separation, but they only referred to it when I did. After breakfast, Joe brought out my indentures from the press in the best parlor, and we put them in the fire, and I felt that I was free. With all the novelty of my emancipation on me, I went to church with Joe, and thought, perhaps the clergyman wouldn't have read that about the rich man and the kingdom of heaven, if he had known all. After our early dinner I strolled out alone, purposing to finish off the marshes at once, and get them done with. As I passed the church, I felt as I had felt during service in the morning, a sublime compassion for the poor creatures who were destined to go there, Sunday after Sunday, all their lives through, and to lie obscurely at last among the low green mounds. I promised myself that I would do something for them one of these days, and formed a plan in outline for bestowing a dinner of roast beef and plum pudding, a pint of ale, and a gallon of condescension, upon everybody in the village. If I had often thought before, with something allied to shame, of my companionship with the fugitive whom I had once seen limping among those graves, what were my thoughts on this Sunday, when the place recalled the wretch, ragged and shivering, with his felon iron and badge? My comfort was, that it happened a long time ago, and that he had doubtless been transported a long way off, and that he was dead to me, and might be veritably dead into the bargain. No more low wet grounds, no more dikes and sluices, no more of these grazing cattle though they seemed, in their dull manner, to wear a more respectful air now, and to face round, in order that they might stare, as long as possible at the possessor of such great expectations. Farewell, monotonous acquaintances of my childhood, henceforth I was for London and greatness. Not for Smith's work in general and for you. I made my exultant way to the old battery, and, lying down there to consider the question whether Miss Havisham intended me for Stella, fell asleep. When I awoke, I was much surprised to find Joe sitting beside me, smoking his pipe. He greeted me with a cheerful smile on my opening my eyes, and said, "As being the last time, Pip, I thought I'd fool her. And Joe, I am very glad you did so. Thank ye, Pip. You may be sure, dear Joe," I went on, after we had shaken hands, "that I shall never forget you." "No, no, Pip," said Joe, in a comfortable tone, "I'm sure of that. Eh, old chap. Bless you, it were only necessary to get it well round in a man's mind, to be certain on it. But it took a bit of time, to get it well round, the change come so uncommon plump, didn't it?" Somehow, I was not best pleased with Joe's, being so mightily secure of me. I should have liked him to have betrayed emotion, or to have said, "It does you credit, Pip," or something of that sort. Therefore, I made no remark on Joe's first head, merely saying as to his second, that the tidings had indeed come suddenly, but that I had always wanted to be a gentleman, and had often and often speculated on what I would do, if I were one. "Have you though?" said Joe. "Astonishing. It's a pity now, Joe," said I, "that you did not get on a little more, when we had our lessons here, isn't it?" "Well, I don't know," returned Joe. "I'm so awful dull. I'm only master of my own trade. It were always a pity as I was so awful dull, but it's no more of a pity now, than it was this day 12th, don't you see? What I had meant was, that when I came into my property, and was able to do something for Joe, it would have been much more agreeable, if he had been better qualified for a rise in station. He was so perfectly innocent of my meaning, however, that I thought I would mention it to Biddy in preference. So, when we had walked home, and had had tea, I took Biddy into our little garden by the side of the lane, and, after throwing out in a general way for the elevation of her spirits, that I should never forget her, said I had a favor to ask of her. And it is, Biddy, said I, that you will not omit any opportunity of helping Joe on, a little. How helping him on? Asked Biddy, with a steady sort of glance. Well, Joe is a dear good fellow, in fact, I think he is the dearest fellow that ever lived, but he is rather backward in some things. For instance, Biddy, in his learning and his manners. Although I was looking at Biddy as I spoke, and although she opened her eyes very wide when I had spoken, she did not look at me. Oh, his manners. Won't his manners do, then? Asked Biddy, plucking a black currant leaf. My dear Biddy, they do very well here, oh. They do very well here? Interrupted Biddy, looking closely at the leaf in her hand. Hear me out, but if I were to remove Joe into a higher sphere, as I shall hope to remove him, when I fully come into my property, they would hardly do him justice. And don't you think he knows that? Asked Biddy. It was such a very provoking question, for it had never in the most distant manner occurred to me, that I said, snappishly, Biddy, what do you mean? Biddy, having rubbed the leaf to pieces between her hands, and the smell of a black currant bush has ever since recalled to me that evening in the little garden by the side of the lane, said, have you never considered that he may be proud? Proud? I repeated, with disdainful emphasis. Oh, there are many kinds of pride, said Biddy, looking full at me, and shaking her head. Pride is not all of one kind. Well, what are you stopping for? Said one. Not all of one kind, resumed Biddy. He may be too proud to let anyone take him out of a place that he is competent to fill, and fills well and with respect. To tell you the truth, I think he is. Though it sounds bold in me to say so, for you must know him far better than I do. Now, Biddy, said I am very sorry to see this in you. I did not expect to see this in you. You are envious, Biddy, and grudging. You are dissatisfied on account of my rise in fortune, and you can't help showing it. If you have the heart to think so, returned Biddy, say so. Say so over and over again, if you have the heart to think so. If you have the heart to be so, you mean, Biddy, said I, in a virtuous and superior tone. Don't put it off upon me. I am very sorry to see it, and it's a bad side of human nature. I didn't intend to ask you to use any little opportunities you might have, after I was gone, of improving dear Joe. But after this, I ask you nothing. I am extremely sorry to see this in you, Biddy, I repeated. It's a bad side of human nature. Whether you scold me, or approve of me, returned poor Biddy, you may equally depend upon my trying to do all that lies in my power, here, at all times. And whatever opinion you take away of me, shall make no difference in my remembrance of you. Yet a gentleman should not be unjust neither, said Biddy, turning away her head. I again warmly repeated that it was a bad side of human nature, in which sentiment, waiving its application, I have since seen reason to think I was right, and I walked down the little path away from Biddy, and Biddy went into the house, and I went out at the garden gate, and took a dejected stroll until supper time, again feeling it very sorrowful and strange that this, the second night of my bright fortunes, should be as lonely and unsatisfactory as the first. But, morning once more brightened my view, and I extended my clemency to Biddy, and we dropped the subject. Putting on the best clothes I had, I went into town as early as I could hope to find the shops open, and presented myself before Mr. Trabb, the tailor, who was having his breakfast in the parlor behind his shop, and who did not think it worth his while to come out to me, but called me into him. Well, said Mr. Trabb, in a hail fellow well met kind of way, how are you, and what can I do for you? Mr. Trabb had sliced his hot roll into three feather beds, and was slipping butter in between the blankets, and covering it up. He was a prosperous old bachelor, and his open window looked into a prosperous little garden and orchard, and there was a prosperous iron safe let into the wall at the side of his fireplace, and I did not doubt that heaps of his prosperity were put away in it in bags. "Mr. Trabb," said I, "it's an unpleasant thing to have to mention, because it looks like boasting, but I have come into a handsome property." A change passed over Mr. Trabb. He forgot the butter in bed, got up from the bedside, and wiped his fingers on the tablecloth, exclaiming, "Lord bless my soul! I am going up to my guardian in London," said I, casually drawing some guineas out of my pocket and looking at them, "and I want a fashionable suit of clothes to go in. I wish to pay for them," I added, "otherwise I thought he might only pretend to make them with ready money." "My dear sir," said Mr. Trabb, as he respectfully bent his body, opened his arms, and took the liberty of touching me on the outside of each elbow, "don't hurt me by mentioning that. May I venture to congratulate you? Would you do me the favor of stepping into the shop?" Mr. Trapp's boy was the most audacious boy in all that countryside. When I had entered, he was sweeping the shop, and he had sweetened his labors by sweeping over me. He was still sweeping when I came out into the shop with Mr. Trabb, and he knocked the broom against all possible corners and obstacles, to express, as I understood it, equality with any blacksmith, alive or dead. "Hold that noise," said Mr. Trabb, with the greatest sternness, "or I'll knock your head off. Do me the favor to be seated, sir." "Now, this," said Mr. Trabb, taking down a roll of cloth, and tidying it out in a flowing manner over the counter, preparatory to getting his hand under it to show the gloss, "is a very sweet article. I can recommend it for your purpose, sir, because it really is extra super. But you shall see some others. Give me number 4, you." To the boy, and with a dreadfully severe stare. Foreseeing the danger of that miscreant's brushing me with it, or making some other sign of familiarity, Mr. Trabb never removed his stern eye from the boy until he had deposited number 4 on the counter, and was at a safe distance again. Then, he commanded him to bring number 5, and number 8. "And let me have none of your tricks here," said Mr. Trabb, "or you shall repent it, you young scoundrel, the longest day you have to live." Mr. Trabb then bent over number 4, and in a sort of deferential confidence recommended it to me as a light article for summer wear, an article much in vogue among the nobility and gentry, an article that it would ever be an honor to him to reflect upon a distinguished fellow townsman's, if he might claim me for a fellow townsman, having worn. "Are you bringing numbers 5 and 8, you vagabond?" said Mr. Trabb to the boy after that, "or shall I kick you out of the shop, and bring them myself?" I selected the materials for a suit, with the assistance of Mr. Trapp's judgment, and re-entered the parlor to be measured. For, although Mr. Trabb had my measure already, and had previously been quite contented with it, he said apologetically, that it wouldn't do under existing circumstances, sir, wouldn't do at all. So, Mr. Trabb measured and calculated me, in the parlor, as if I were an estate, and he the finest species of surveyor, and gave himself such a world of trouble, that I felt that no suit of clothes could possibly remunerate him for his pains. When he had at last done and had appointed to send the articles to Mr. Pumblecook's on the Thursday evening, he said, with his hand upon the parlor lock, "I know, sir, that London gentlemen cannot be expected to patronize local work, as a rule, but if you would give me a turn now, and then in the quality of a townsman, I should greatly esteem it. Good morning, sir, much obliged. Door." The last word was flung at the boy, who had not the least notion what it meant. But I saw him collapse as his master rubbed me out with his hands, and my first decided experience of the stupendous power of money was that it had morally laid upon his back, Trapp's boy. After this memorable event, I went to the hatters, and the bootmakers, and the hosiers, and felt rather like Mother Hubbard's dog whose outfit required the services of so many trades. I also went to the coach office and took my place for 7 o'clock on Saturday morning. It was not necessary to explain everywhere that I had come into a handsome property, but whenever I said anything to that effect, it followed that the officiating tradesman ceased to have his attention diverted through the window by the high street and concentrated his mind upon me. When I had ordered everything I wanted, I directed my steps towards Pumblechook's, and, as I approached that gentleman's place of business, I saw him standing at his door. He was waiting for me with great impatience. He had been out early in the chaise cart, and had called at the forge, and heard the news. He had prepared a collation for me in the Barnwell parlor, and he too ordered his shopman to come out of the gangway as my sacred person passed. "My dear friend," said Mr. Pumblechook, taking me by both hands, "when he and I and the collation were alone, I give you joy of your good fortune. Well deserved, well deserved." This was coming to the point, and I thought it a sensible way of expressing himself. "To think," said Mr. Pumblechook, after snorting admiration at me for some moments, "that I should have been the humble instrument of leading up to this, is a proud reward." I begged Mr. Pumblechook to remember that nothing was to be ever said or hinted on that point. "My dear young friend," said Mr. Pumblechook, "if you will allow me..." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.